Okay, slide 14. We're looking at the contraction of a sarcomere, actually two sarcomeres here. Just keep in mind that there would be many, many sarcomeres end-to-end making up one myofibril, and then there would be many myofibrils side-by-side making up one myofiber, which is one cell. But anyway, the way in which these sarcomeres contract is illustrated here, and this is known as the sliding filament model of muscular contraction. It's what I was actually trying to analogize with my fingers sliding past each other and my thumbs approaching each other. Here you see it in cartoon form, though, with two sarcomeres displayed. So the brown are the thick filaments, the blue are the thin filaments. Which one has actin? Thin filaments, the thick filaments, are myosin, and they have the myosin heads on them. The myosin heads will bind to binding sites on G-actin molecules, the individual beads that make up an F-actin strand on the thin filament. But that will happen only if those binding sites are exposed. So here we're assuming they are, and that happens. And remember the definitions of these various parts of the sarcomere, these lines and zones and bands. The A band is the full length of a myosin molecule or filament, and so during contraction the A band stays the same side because the sliding filament model says that these filaments aren't getting shorter, they're just increasing their overlap. On the other hand, the I band, which is the part of the myosin where there is, I mean the part of the actin filament where there is no myosin overlapping it, does decrease, because as you increase the overlap between myosin and actin, there's less of a place where there is no overlap. All right, the actin itself though is not shortening, just the I band is shortening. And similarly, the H zone, which is the part of the myosin where there is no overlap with actin, is shortening. So as those two bands get shorter, the H zone and the I band, since they're part of the sarcomere, the overall sarcomere gets shorter. And since that's happening simultaneously in all of the sarcomeres that are linked end to end in a myofibril, that means the entire myofibril is shortening. The exact same thing is happening in all of the other myofibrils that are running parallel to it, making up that one muscle cell. And since the muscle cell runs the entire length of the whole muscle, that means the whole muscle is getting shorter. Now, it's not necessarily true that every myofiber is shortening actively at the same time in the whole muscle, and that's why the strength of contraction of the whole muscle can vary. It depends on how many myofibers are actually actively shortening, but even if only a few of them are, since they run the whole length of the whole muscle is shortening, just not with as much force. Well, in B, on the right side, we see what's called a length tension diagram. And so on the y-axis is tension, so that's force of contraction, versus the length of the sarcomere. What this shows you, since this isn't just a horizontal line, is that the length of the sarcomere to begin with, when you start trying to contract the muscle, affects how much force you can generate in that muscle. And the cartoons above the graph explain why. If a muscle is stretched, and by the way, no muscle pushes. A muscle doesn't actively get long. It can only get shorter. Something else, like gravity or another muscle pulling on that first muscle, needs to be applied in order to make it longer. But if a muscle gets stretched too far out, then you don't have any overlap between actin and myosin, and therefore the cross bridges, as they're called, when those myosin heads attach to the actin, don't form. And unless those form, you can't increase the overlap. So that's why it goes all the way down to zero here, corresponding to number one, because the thing has been stretched too far. Well, as you increase the overlap to start with in 2 and 3, notice that the force of contraction gets higher and higher. Now think about trying to lift a dumbbell. If you start with your elbow entirely extended, your upper limb totally straight, and you lift a dumbbell that is the heaviest one that you're able to lift, well, you won't be able to lift it if you start all the way down here. But if you start halfway, in which case your muscles are overlapping more already before you start generating the force, then you can lift a heavier one. And that's because of this greater overlap. So there's an optimal length to start at, which is a little bit of overlap so you can get started well, but also some room to go. At the other extreme, on 5, if you start out with it too bunched up to begin with, then the proteins that make up these sarcomeres start running into each other. You make the sarcomere so short that you're cramming things into too much space and they interfere with each other. So it comes back down when it gets too short. A middle length is the optimum length to start with for maximal tension development. Okay, now let's look at this crossbridge formation in slide 15. It's a cycle of crossbridge formation because if a crossbridge formed, which is the bond between a myosin head and a G-actin on an F-actin thin filament, if that's the only thing that happened, then you wouldn't be able to continue to shorten that muscle. It would get very slightly shorter, and then nothing else would happen. So it has to be like a tug of war. In a tug of war, you don't pull a certain distance and then say, oh, okay, we're done, right? You pull if you can, and then when you've gotten your arms back to your body, you let go, grab down farther on the rope so you can pull it even more. That's what has to happen here. These myosin heads need to be able to bind, drag the actin across the myosin, and then unbind, grab farther on down the line, and do that over and over. And as long as that continues, then you have increased overlap between actin and myosin, or thin and thick filaments, and therefore shortening of the sarcomeres. So if we start at number one here, actually to the left of number one, this myosin head that's shown to the left of number one has not formed a cross bridge yet. But it is cocked, so it's in a position where it is ready to bind to a G-actin active site. And notice that it has attached to it an ADP and an inorganic phosphate, both. All right? Well, assuming that tropomyosin is out of the way, which we are assuming here, then there is a G-actin available right there in the position that this myosin head is, and so a crossbridge will form. All right, that will happen just automatically as long as this thing is cocked. But when that bond, when that crossbridge forms, that's like a ligand binding to a protein, right? So something happens, a change of shape happens, and something results from that. Well, the inorganic phosphate pops off in this case, and the conformational change is such that the hinge between the myosin head and the shaft of the myosin changes its angle. And that is what actually provides the force to increase the overlap between actin and myosin. That's what drags the thin filament toward the middle, toward the M line, increasing the overlap between thick and thin. That is called the power stroke. Right? And that's where the energy is used. But notice that no ATP has been involved yet. It's been ADP, But that ADP is still ADP. All right? Now, it's important to be able to break that cross bridge, like I was saying. You need to grab onto the rope farther on down the line if you want continued contraction. So this is where ATP finally comes into play. ATP is not used to cause the power stroke directly. ATP is used to break the cross bridge. All right? So if ATP is available, it will bind to the myosin head that's still in a cross bridge with actin, and that will detach it. Okay? Now, the energy of ATP has still not been spent. It just caused the detachment. But then immediately, ATP will be hydrolyzed by the myosin head. The myosin head itself has ATPase activity. It acts as an enzyme that can hydrolyze ATP. And when that happens, you no longer have ATP. You have ADP and inorganic phosphate, but that releases energy. The energy that's released in that recocks the myosin head and puts it back into that more extended position so that when it grabs onto an actin again, it will be a G-actin that's farther down the line, not in the same position. So that's where the energy is actually spent directly, in recocking the myosin head. Okay? Now, importantly, if you didn't have ATP, the cross bridge wouldn't be destroyed. And this is exactly why rigor mortis happens. When you die, officially, you're dead because your brain is no longer functioning. But that doesn't mean at that instant every cell is dead, right? There are still cells that are operating. And your muscles will still be able to make these cross bridges as long as there's ATP, which there will be for a while until it's all used up. Once it's all used up, because you're dead, then whatever position your muscles are in, those cross bridges that are formed will not be able to be broken. And that's why the body stiffens up. All right, let's go to 16. This is a very close-up view, and it's an end view of what's happening with the myosin. So this is a circle because we're looking at the thick filament from the end view. And this is a myosin head that's sticking off of it. And this is explaining why sometimes cross-bridge formation happens, sometimes it doesn't. That is under the control of tropomyosin directly, right? Remember, tropomyosin is the protein component of the thin filament that is normally in a position that covers all of those myosin head binding sites of the G-actin monomers of the F-actin filament. You can see that tropomyosin is all three of these TNs, and in this position, tropomyosin is in the way. And therefore, this myosin head has no way of making a cross bridge with the blue myosin binding site on G-actin. I say normally, what I mean by normally is at rest, when the muscle is not being contracted. And skeletal muscle gets contracted only when a neuron tells it to, which means only when you decide to fire that neuron with your brain will your muscles contract. If that happens, though, then tropomyosin needs to be dragged out of the way. And the way that tropomyosin is dragged out of the way... I'm sorry, did I say that TN was tropomyosin? It's troponin. Green is tropomyosin. That's what's in the way. But what drags tropomyosin out of the way is the fact that it's connected to troponin. All right? So troponin gets dragged out of the way because of tropomyosin gets dragged out of the way because of conformational change in troponin, which occurs if and when calcium ions bind to troponin. Remember that troponin has three connection points, two of which are permanent. One of those connection points anchors it to actin, one of it anchors it to tropomyosin, and then the third one can bind to a calcium ion. If there's no calcium ion present, then it will troponin will be in a position that will put tropomyosin in the way. If calcium ions are there, the conformational change in troponin is such that it will drag tropomyosin out of the way, allowing for the cross bridge to form between the myosin head and the G actin. Yeah. Yes.
So what does it give up? Does it give up calcium? No.
In fact, we're going to look at that in the next, probably the next slide. Next couple of slides. Okay, 17. Here we're looking at a close-up view of just part of a myofiber. This is the whole width of the myofiber. It's just not the whole length. And so within this myofiber, we have several myofibrils. There would actually be more than four, but this is a simplification. And notice that we're looking at just a couple sarcomeres worth of the length of these myofibrils. There's one sarcomere from this Z line to the next Z line, which, even though it's not labeled, is in the middle of that I band that's labeled. All right, that's one sarcomere. I think last time I told you that in the case of a skeletal myofiber, the endoplasmic reticulum gets the special name sarcoplasmic reticulum. So that's what all of this greenish stuff is. It's the endoplasmic reticulum of a myofiber, the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And it is very elaborate in a muscle cell, which is extraordinarily long for a cell. So there's a lot of this sarcoplasmic reticulum all the way through the length of that entire myofiber. And it's called a reticulum because it forms a network. It's a very elaborate network of tubing made of membrane. But at each sarcomere, there are a couple places in which these tubes come together to form what are called cisternae, terminal cisternae. Now, cisterna, there's the spelling of cisternae. Cisterna is a singular of that. Cistern means tank. So these terminal cisternae are the principal place where calcium ions are stored. And the lumen of the terminal cisternae is a separate chamber compared to the cytoplasm because of the membrane, right? It's compartmentalization. So the muscle cell is continuously using ATP to pump calcium ions from the cytosol into the lumen of the terminal cisternae. In other words, the cell is always spending energy ensuring that calcium ions are rare in the cytosol. It's sequestering them in the terminal cisternae. Now, two terminal cisternae come together on either side of what is called a T-tubule, which is short for transverse tubule, because it's positioned in a transverse fashion, 90 degrees to the long axis. But this T-tubule is really just an invagination of the plasma membrane. The plasma membrane, by the way, gets its own name in a skeletal muscle cell as well. It's called the sarcolemma. Just another name for the plasma membrane of a myofiber. By invagination, I mean an infolding. So it's the same membrane, but it folds in deep into the cell, forming these transverse tubules. Since it's an invagination from the surface, that means the lumen of the transverse tubule is actually continuous with the extracellular fluid. It's outside of the cell. Does that make sense? Okay, so this mustard-colored T-tubule and the two terminal cisternae, one on either side of it, all three of those things together form a triad, which simply means a three-part thing. Okay, so you have a couple triads per sarcomere. That's the arrangement of things. Now, the reason that the transverse tubules are important is because they are going to propagate what are called action potentials, which are changes in voltage occurring at the membrane that makes up that transverse tubule. And when you have a change in voltage, that can cause things to happen that wouldn't happen if you didn't have that change. In other words, voltage changes, or action potentials serve as signals. If these action potentials are created in the muscle cell and get propagated down these T-tubules into the interior of the cell, then they will cause the opening of voltage-gated calcium ion channels that are embedded in the membranes of the terminal cisternae. Now, these terminal cisternae also have plenty of pumps that are, like I said, always using ATP to pump calcium ions into the terminal cisternae. But when the right voltage comes along as an action potential propagated down to the T-tubule, that's going to invoke these totally other kinds of proteins also in the terminal cisternal membrane. That these are the ones I'm calling voltage-gated calcium ion channels, that when the voltage is applied, open up, and now they're just calcium ion channels. Remember, a channel is just an opening. So the only direction something's going to move through a channel is down its gradient. Since the pumps produced a strong gradient for diffusion of calcium ions out of the terminal cisterna and into the cytoplasm, that's exactly what happens. In response to that voltage, the action potential, voltage-gated calcium ion channels open up and release these stored calcium ions into the cytoplasm. Now they are available, the calcium ions, to bind to the troponin molecules that we've talked about, changing their shape, which is what's going to drag the tropomyosin out of the way, and that's what finally then allows the myosin heads to form cross bridges with G-actin. All right? And that's happening when you, as with your brain, are telling the muscle to have that action potential. All right? That's why these are consciously controlled muscles. When you quit trying to exert force with that muscle, everything reverses. The pumps take that calcium ion back out of the cytoplasm, put it back into the terminal cisterna. It becomes so rare in the cytoplasm that it diffuses away from the troponin molecules, putting them back into their original shape, which puts tropomyosin in the way and blocks myosin from binding to G-actin. And therefore, that's analogous to the whole team on the tug of war letting go of the rope. And therefore, either the muscle stays in place if there's no force being exerted in the other direction, or if gravity is there, like when I just relax my muscle, gravity takes over and pulls that muscle. Because none of these cross bridges are forming anymore. That's relaxation. All right, so then the question is, how do the action potentials get created in the muscle cell? Well, action potentials are changes in voltage. And the voltage doesn't actually travel. We say that an action potential is propagated down the length of an excitable cell. An excitable cell is a cell that's able to produce an action potential. A single action potential is a change in membrane voltage just at a tiny region of that overall cell. But that action potential, since it's a change in voltage, is going to trigger an action potential in the next little slice of membrane next to it. And so that's what action potential propagation is. It's a chain reaction. One causes another one right beside it, which then causes another one right beside it. It's quite analogous to the toppling of the first domino, if you have them all set up. The dominoes don't travel down the length of that, right? What happens is that the toppling propagates in a wave until the final one has toppled at the other end. It's a chain reaction. That's how action potentials travel. Well, the action potential gets created in a myofiber in response to the inflow of sodium ions. Now, sodium ions, as you recall, are always in greater concentration in the extracellular fluid because of the sodium-potassium exchange pumps, right? So if a sodium ion channel opens up, sodium is going to diffuse down its gradient, come into the cell. that sodium ion coming into the cell is the change in voltage that is going to cause an action potential. And then once you have an action potential started, it's going to propagate down the whole length of the cell, including into those transverse tubules. So now the question is, what causes sodium ion channels to open up in the sarcolemma, the plasma membrane of the myofiber, to get the ball rolling? Well, like I said, it only happens in skeletal muscle cells. It only happens if you are consciously telling it to, which means only if a neuron is firing, a neuron that happens to innervate that myofiber. To innervate means for a nerve to connect to it, a neuron to connect to it. Right? That's what we're looking at here. This is called the neuromuscular junction. This is the axon terminal. It's the end of the long neuron. We're looking at just the end where it connects to the muscle. So the neuromuscular junction is an example of a synapse. A synapse is a connection between a neuron and some other cell. Okay? Neurons, in addition to muscle cells, are excitable. Neurons operate via action potentials also. And so your intention to contract whatever muscle this is creates the action potential in the neuron. We're not going to get into how that happens, but just assume that it does. That action potential propagates by chain reaction down the length of that axon until it reaches the neuromuscular junction. In response to that action potential, which is a change in voltage in the neuron, reaching the end, that voltage opens up voltage-gated calcium ion channels that are in the axon plasma membrane. Very similar situation to what I said happens at the triad or at the terminal cisterna. Only these voltage-gated calcium ion channels are in the axon. Well, calcium ions are in greater concentration in the extracellular fluid than the intracellular fluid. So in response to this neuronal action potential, the opening of voltage-gated calcium ion channels causes calcium ions to move into the neuron. And it's this influx of calcium ions that triggers exocytosis, the exocytotic release of a chemical called a neurotransmitter. When the voltage signal reaches the end of a neuron, the result is that it will release a chemical called a neurotransmitter. Now, there are different neurotransmitters that are used for different reasons in different parts of the body, but at the skeletal neuromuscular junction, which is what we're looking at here, the particular neurotransmitter is acetylcholine. Okay, so that's what these little red... that's not what those represent. We don't see the detail of that. But acetylcholine, or ACH for short, is now a ligand. That's what neurotransmitters are. They're chemical signals, and chemical signals operate as ligands. They don't have any effect unless they can bind to a receptor. Where are those receptors? They are proteins that are embedded in the membrane of the sarcolemma, the plasma membrane of the myofiber, which is a tiny distance away. The synapse has just a little bit of intracellular fluid between the neuron and the muscle cell. So the neurotransmitters, when they're released by exocytosis from vesicles that are in the neuron, diffuse that tiny distance across the synaptic cleft, as it's called, and then bind to acetylcholine receptors in the muscle cell. Well, these acetylcholine receptors have double duty. They act as a receptor, and they therefore change in shape when the acetylcholine binds to them. But their other job is that the shape change causes them to open up as channels, specifically for sodium ions. So that's the direct result of the acetylcholine binding to the receptors in the muscle cell. It causes the opening of sodium ion channels, and since sodium is in greater concentration in the extracellular fluid, it floods into the cytoplasm of the muscle cell. That's what causes the first change in voltage that then leads to an action potential being propagated down the entire length of the myofiber. All right? Is this making sense? Well, it will, right? It will by Friday. This change in voltage. So that's the first toppling of the domino. And then it's just automatic from there. So this action potential, this is a new action potential that's created in the muscle cell. It's different from the original action potential. The action potential in the muscle cell now propagates automatically down its length, including into each transverse tubule. And since that action potential is a voltage, when it reaches those transverse tubules, it brings that voltage close enough to the voltage-gated calcium ion channels in the terminal cisternae for them to open up. And when the calcium ion channels open up in the terminal cisternae, that's when the calcium comes out into the cytoplasm, binds to the troponin, causes the conformational change that will drag tropomyosin out of the way, allowing for myosin head cross-bridge formation. Okay, that's contraction. And that will continue to happen as long as your brain is continuing to produce new action potentials in the neuron, which will continue to release acetylcholine, producing new action potentials in the muscle cell. As soon as you quit thinking about contracting, everything will stop. The calcium ions will be pumped back into the terminal cisternae, and no more cross-bridge formation, and the muscle will be relaxed. All right, now let's go to 19. If there are no questions on any of that. The muscles we're looking at here, these muscle cells, are not skeletal muscle cells. These are cardiac muscle cells. There's three types of muscle in your body: cardiac muscle, skeletal muscle, and smooth muscle. And cardiac muscle and smooth muscle are similar. They're both striated muscle, meaning that they have sarcomere structure to them, and they therefore cause little striations. You can see them as bands. But there are a couple major differences between cardiac and skeletal muscle. One is that a skeletal muscle cell is a long cylinder, a right regular cylinder for you math nerds. Doesn't branch. Cardiac myofibers, which can also be called myocytes, are cylindrical, but they branch also. And that's why the striations isn't quite as beautiful in cardiac muscle as it is in skeletal muscle, because the branching makes them go in a different direction, so it's not all lined up perfectly. But anyway, another major difference is that when the two blunt ends of cardiac myofibers come into contact, two different cells butted up against each other, there's a special structural arrangement between those cells called an intercalated disc. So the intercalated disc is the boundary between two different myofibers, cardiac myofibers. And in these intercalated discs are what are called gap junctions, which, as the name implies, feature little holes that allow for the direct movement of ions from one myofiber to the next myofiber. Well, ions carry charge, so they are the things responsible for these voltages in the action potentials we're talking about. Therefore, if ions can flow from one cell to the next, action potentials can directly travel from one cardiac myofiber to the next. It's not true in skeletal myofibers. An action potential is created in a single skeletal muscle, and that doesn't jolt the one it's next to into also creating an action potential. The reason this is important in cardiac myofibers is because when the heart contracts, you want every cell, every muscle cell in that whole heart chamber to contract at once, or as much as simultaneously as possible, so that it can effectively operate as a pump. So this is another example of a synapse. This synapse, though, the intercalated disc, is an example of what's called an electrical synapse. In an electrical synapse, an action potential can travel directly across the synapse, and it's just all one action potential from involving both cells. The neuromuscular junction that I showed you earlier is a synapse that's an example of what's called a chemical synapse. And that's because the neuronal action potential ends, it causes the release of a chemical, which is the neurotransmitter, and then the neurotransmitter indirectly causes the creation of a brand new action potential in the other cell, the muscle cell in this case. So there's an intermediate step. It doesn't travel directly. Another major difference functionally is that cardiac muscle is not under conscious control, which is nice because it would be a bitch to have to remember to beat your heart throughout the day. Smooth muscle is shown in slide 20. And it has, even though it acts because of actin and myosin interaction also, smooth muscles don't have sarcomeric structure. They have actin-myosin bundles, as you see here. Oh, also, as far as the shape is concerned, they're not as long as skeletal muscles, but they're longer than most cells. They're also not right regular cylinders. They have tapered ends. They come to little points. So they're spindle-shaped. Fatter in the middle, tapered at the ends, unlike the other two muscle cells. But they also don't consist of sarcomeres. They have these actin-myosin bundles that are connected to what are called dense bodies, which are collections of proteins forming plaques. And these dense bodies are in turn connected to intermediate filaments, which are cytoskeletal elements, right? Those are also proteins in this kind of diagonal pattern. So that in response to contraction, the shortening of the bundles of actin and myosin pull on the dense bodies, which pull on the intermediate filaments, and this causes this whole thing to basically get fatter in the middle, scrunch up, as you see on the bottom here. Now, smooth muscle cells also are not consciously controlled. This happens behind the scenes. The contractions are much slower, but they're also much longer. They occur for much longer time. And smooth muscles line your hollow organs, so they push the contents of those hollow organs through that, whatever it might be. Urine through the ureters, chyme through the digestive tract, whatever. 21, I think, is... No, it's not the final. It's the penultimate. In 21, we're looking at cell crawling, which also involves actin and myosin interaction. But this is a single cell moving around on a substrate. And the substrate can be other cells within a multicellular body, for that matter. But cell crawling involves forming connections with the substrate, elongating part of the cell, contracting another part of the cell, moving cytoplasm around. All of that actually involves actin, but it's doing different things in different places in the cell at once. This lamellipodium that's listed at the top, this is a flat sheet that gets moved outward at the leading edge of the crawling. And that involves actin actually being polymerized, so that it gets longer in that area. The connection between the cell and the substrate itself is called a focal adhesion. We see that on the bottom inset. And that involves many different proteins, but actin is there as well. For this thing to continue to move forward, it needs to stretch out on the front, contract on the back, make new focal adhesions toward the front, and then detach the focal adhesions that it already made behind it over and over. So this is obviously it's going to involve a lot of energy expenditure, but it's also going to involve a lot of actin being polymerized, depolymerized, and moved around. The final slide, 22, shows you cyclosis or cytoplasmic streaming. Cytoplasmic streaming is actually not all cytoplasmic streaming is cyclosis, but all cyclosis is cytoplasmic streaming. Cytoplasmic streaming simply refers to a cell moving cytoplasm around, which also involves interaction with actin. And so crawling cells do this. They stream their cytoplasm move it to different parts of the cell because of this actin. When a plant cell does this, it usually does it in a circular fashion around the nucleus or central vacuole or both. And that's why that particular kind of cytoplasmic streaming is called cyclosis, which you've probably had labs here at West in which you witnessed this. You look at plant leaves under a microscope, and if they get warm and they're lit up from the microscope for long enough, you can see the chloroplasts start to move around like a merry-go-round around the central vacuole. That's cyclosis. Well, that's happening. That's not for free. There's a lot of energy being spent to do that, but it's happening because of actin, just like in your skeletal muscles, but for a totally different reason. And so that's the unit. Yeah, go ahead. Well, we don't know for sure. One reason is that they can position chloroplasts toward the light more. Another, though, is just to simply mix things up in the cytoplasm. And so different species do it to different degrees, but we've studied it a lot, but why exactly, don't really know. Thank you.